This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. This is the morning run, 14th of September, Wednesday, and you're with Sharad Kutan, Melissa Idris, and myself, Julian Ng. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
How are you guys feeling this morning?
Morning. I'm super excited. I don't know why. I guess because really? It's midweek and I know the week is ending soon.
Oh, that's
right. It's true. I could use a bit more sleep. I think that would always help. And in fact, but you know, you're right, Melissa, they can look forward to a long, long weekend after, you know, another long weekend.
I think every week should be like this week.
No, I actually, what I found was that because it's a 3-day work week, all the work that we need to get done in a week has been condensed into 3 working days. So I feel a buzz with adrenaline simply because I know the sheer amount of work on my desk.
It's like being in a boxing match and being punched in the face so many times that you don't feel the pain anymore.
You don't feel the pain.
Okay, what about that? So what would the trade-off be? Would it be a reasonable trade-off? These condensed, hyper-intense days, but long weekends. So if you say had 4 really intense days and 3 days off on a weekend, would that be something you're willing to do?
These are rhetorical questions.
No, but it's
right?
It's a good question. No, if
a thought experiment.
Yeah, so for instance, would I prefer working, say, 12, 15 hours a day and getting a 3-day, 4-day weekend? Would that make the 3 days of, you know, being exhausted and tired and lack of sleep worth it? I don't know. Actually, that's a really good question.
I would love it, actually.
You would? You would?
Yeah.
But you would find yourself so cranky in those 3 days.
I think it's a matter of just organizing your day to do the most intellectually pressing matters at the earlier part of the day. And then the later part of the day, just doing all the normal, mundane stuff.
That doesn't require mental strength.
Yeah, that might be one solution. I mean, you remember the good old days when there were 5.5 days worth of work for a lot of people?
Five and a half, yes.
Yeah, and what was that half day about, right?
So, but didn't they also just work from 9 to 4?
Yes, not 9 to 4. It was a half day. I think they worked to noon.
For Saturday?
Yeah, for Saturday.
No, for normal days, did they just work 4?
I don't think so. I think they worked 9 to 5. I think it was a... I can't remember.
It's a long time.
What was Saturday for? So was it just phased out of the working world?
Yeah, it was. I mean, you don't remember it?
Well, I wasn't working during the 5 and a half.
I did have that half day thing, and I totally hated it because I was not an early riser like what I am today.
You're part of the morning run. Early riser is coded in your DNA.
And of course, this whole question of say banks and companies that or organizations that provide services, you know, working on a Saturday meant that people who worked from throughout the week had a chance perhaps then to go to and avail themselves of those services on the weekend.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I tell you, it's a total waste of time because we come in, we have our cup of tea or coffee, read the newspapers, and then the half day is gone.
Yeah.
So I totally detested the half day, and I would never work with a firm that required a half day on Saturday.
Luckily, we've gone to a 5-day working week. Perhaps in the future, we might even see a 4-day work week. Right?
Yeah. Okay, let's hope this person would be wide awake to come in for the breakfast grill today. He's Karim Raslan, founder and CEO of the KRA Group, which is a public affairs consulting firm with an ASEAN focus. And he's been writing a lot of essays recently that range from advocacy initiatives to the labor movement within ASEAN.
Yeah, so he's the author of that long-running column, Cerita Lah. It's been syndicated by many, many newspapers and I think translated into many languages. And he's going to be discussing, I think it's just interesting to kind of tap his mind because he's a really noted Southeast Asian commentator. And he kind of travels around the region to talk to people, find out their story and to learn about the country through its people rather than, you know, what you see at a surface level. So he, I believe, just before the general elections, the 13th general elections, he did a series across Malaysia where he just, you know, went to talk to regular folk on the ground. It was really quite fascinating. And he's got his latest installment is called Cerita Lah ASEAN, in which he goes to different countries around the region to to explore the idea of ASEAN. Can ASEAN work? Can an ASEAN community really work? Because he argues that it's just an elitist pipe dream. It was put together by a bunch of folks in suits behind plush closed doors. And on the ground, it's not really so.
Well, you know, Karim is an interesting voice because he also emerged in the mid-90s, I believe. You remember Men's Review as a magazine?
Yeah.
Well, he's one of the founders of Men's Review. And I think he was the editor of its first issue.
Was Men's Review like GQ?
Kind of.
Okay.
Well, kind of. No. Not quite. I mean,
not quite so style heavy, but a lot of men issues being written. Quite
editorial.
Good writing.
Well, I worked for them for a short period, I think it was an attempt to create a kind of men's magazine that also took on complex topics. It covered politics. It covered the normal things about style and such. But it really, and some of that kind of laddish stuff was there as well, meaning, kind of interest in girls and, beautiful girls and stuff. But it also broadened
the view.
Not quite
your FHM, but...
not as laddish as FHM. In fact, a little more serious and a bit more gravitas, right? They had major covers, always a personality in that cover. So Karim was involved in that. I think Karim has always been involved in kind of creating conversations, both locally and regionally. And that's kind of makes him an interesting voice, I think.
Yeah. Well, going back to the pipe dream of that ASEAN economic community, I do agree, actually. I think that it would be extremely difficult to integrate a region that's so different culturally, politically, historically.
Why? I mean, the EU did it, despite what we saw
in the
Brexit referendum.
Well, the EU had some cementing factors.
World War II, for starters.
Exactly. I mean, those centuries of
wars. What about the rise of communism within this region? That was one of the reasons why ASEAN was put forward.
Communism is nowhere near survival now. Even China, I mean, China is communist by name and a lot of aspects, but China is also moving away from that communism model.
Well, I think what Melissa is referring to is the fact that the initial bloc ASEAN countries really were the non-communist part.
The fearful
of
communism. Of
Southeast Asia, right? So they were aligned against the communist, countries of the region, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, for the longest time, Myanmar was even part of the grouping. So I think it was just that Cold War logic that brought all those five, founder countries together and managed to keep the peace. And I think the argument has been that, yes, ASEAN might not be, reaching all its aspirations, but it's also must be given credit for keeping the peace, generally.
Well,
in
that's,
a world
that's
of great
ASEAN,
Volta.
As far as the AEC is concerned.
That's totally different because
AEC, I think the leaders themselves have come out to say as much that they don't want to copy the EU model because I think it's quite impossible anyway. And as to the residue of what they want to achieve, it's kind of hard to put your finger on.
Yeah.
I think free movement, free movement of labor, capital, skill, it takes a lot of political resolve to enable that to happen.
Can imagine Singapore having its borders open to labor from around the region?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They'll be just inundated with people from everywhere. We also have, as usual, current affairs at 8:30, and we're going to talk about the US and Russia brokering a ceasefire today.
Yeah, quite interesting because just yesterday, a couple of days ago, in fact, the US and Russia brokered a ceasefire in Syria. This is the second attempt this year by Washington and Moscow to halt the 5-year civil war. And also, Turkish forces also, they've now become the latest foreign power to intervene in Syria. So I think what we're going to do is take a look at the Turkish role in this civil war. What exactly is Turkey doing in Syria? And how this changes the dynamics within the foreign powers already intervening.
Great, interesting stuff. Also, after the 9:30 news, as usual, it's Wednesday, we're going to have the S&M show, which is about stocks and markets, what's working and what's not there. Today, we're going to talk about demystifying the takeover rules. And we're going to have Brian Chia, who is partner at Wong & Partners, who really knows his stuff about, you know, the usual MGOs, VGOs, creeper rules and schemes of arrangements.
So,
goodness, so many acronyms, yeah. So little time. What is an MGO?
Mandatory general offer, and VGO is a voluntary general offer. But, you know, it's quite funny because it comes at a time where the SC is trying to, I guess, revamp. Would you say strengthen is a fair word to use, the takeover code, perhaps to make it in line with other more sophisticated markets? And I use air quotes here, sophisticated markets like Hong Kong and Singapore and the like.
And if I just want to Malaysianize what is being discussed, actually, you know, the latest change is called the scheme of arrangement. So before this, you needed to have at least 50% stake in a certain company to propose a scheme of arrangement to, let's say, save the company. And I may be using this word loosely here. But today, you don't need that amount. You can have any number of shareholding or not to propose to save a company. So the SC made that change so that to enable certain white knights to come in and save certain companies.
You see, this is where I'm a little confused, right? The changes with the takeover code by the SC, it's supposed to be a balance between providing enough protection to the shareholder, to minority shareholders, whilst at the same time making it easier for businesses to do business, right?
Yeah.
So getting that balance right is absolutely key. And I wonder whether they've been successful, essentially.
Well, you know, we'll never know because we won't see a world without these rules. But certainly these are internationally sanctioned rules. A lot of people also do it. And Malaysia, to a certain extent, following international standards there. Just let's look into some news. Big news yesterday for Golden Screen Cinemas because apparently, according to some sources, the billionaire Robert Kuok is buying up GSC for about $500 million.
Oh, I think he's selling it. Is it? He's seeking a buyer for
GSC. Oh, he's seeking. GSC. He owns it now.
He owns it,
Under the PPB group, and he owns it now. So I don't think he'll be having a shortage of buyers.
Well, you know, I just wonder about the future of cinema because,
really?
You know, well, you know, cinemas had...
It's alive and kicking.
Have you been to a cinema recently, a screening?
I have. But, you know, what I'm saying is that there have been challenges to cinema, right? In, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it was the DVD or VCD or whatever, right? And it really made, and, you know, and the rise of home entertainment systems. So people had an almost cinematic experience at home. And then, of course, you have any number of options today with television, especially because they bypass censorship. So why would you go to the cinema today when your movie is likely to be mangled?
To eat popcorn.
Well, no.
Aha. Yeah, in fact,
it's a social event.
You're right.
It's
okay.
Not to watch the movie, but so it's a socializing...
Not to watch the movie?
It's not so much about let's go and watch
also,
the movie.
Also, I think a lot of people can't afford an IMAX at home. So they want to go there.
Not everybody goes for IMAX, right? I mean, IMAX would be the odd one. I mean, in terms of your experience, I'm just saying cinemas are under tremendous pressure to find something special to give to their customers today.
Right.
Because the options have multiplied, have exploded since my days, you know, when I watched, you know, Man with the Golden Gun in the mid-70s.
I have to say though, Sharad, perhaps that's true elsewhere, but here in Malaysia, I really don't think that's the case. I think cinema is alive and kicking simply because Malaysians, we tend to view it as a social event. It's not so much, hey, let's go watch the latest Jason Bourne movie, but hey, it's Friday night. I wonder what's showing.
I heard that wasn't very good.
Well, I have a soft spot for Mr. Bourne. But anyway, you know, it's cheap. It's a cheap night out. It's free.
Well, depending on where you go. Some cinemas are not very cheap at all.
Comparatively, Jules, if you want to talk about a night out on the town, you know, a movie screening is relatively cheaper.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you can do it in a large group. It's free air conditioning. I've heard that many times.
And you go out for dinner. You don't just purposefully go for the movie, right?
You
go for dinner. You have a little chat. You queue up in a popcorn stand and then you watch your movie. Also, I think that cinemas are becoming more and more creative as to how they want to attract the customers. Yeah. For example, 3D, the IMAX, the sound system, the plush chairs.
They are making it like an experience.
Yeah, like the chairs that are actually for a couple, the couple chairs, I think are also
yeah,
big.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the one reality is that this is a place where you get some privacy
dating,
in the midst of a lot of other people.
Yeah, that's true. It will always have ticket sales for the young couples up there.
But I still think that cinemas need to kind of constantly find new things because the options for individuals are tremendous, right? So it's not like the old days when the options were so limited that, you know, everybody went to the cinema. Today, you know, I think the numbers are probably half.
What about the fear of losing out? So some people go and watch a movie, you know, you don't wait for it to turn up on DVD or on your streaming channel. You go and watch it immediately so you can talk about it. For instance, Star Wars. Everyone watched it in the opening weekend because he was so afraid of spoilers.
Yeah, and think that nobody would think of watching Star Wars at home. You got to go to the cinema to do that.
For the cinema effect, right? I mean, yeah. I go to movies because I love the big screen. I love the darkened room. There's no way that any television set or home entertainment system would replicate that.
Have you watched a movie by yourself?
All the time. Yeah. I watch movies all by myself.
That's
all
kind
the
of
time.
A spiritual experience as
oh,
well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, there's no shame in watching a movie on your own.
I love doing that.
Because anyway, when I'm watching a movie, I don't really want to talk to anybody. I do miss, though, the conversation after the movie. If I go alone, then I can't kind of express myself immediately. I have to sort of hook up with somebody later.
Hook up, huh?
You know, like on Skype with a friend.
Well, the money speaks for itself. This year, about $16 billion of entertainment acquisitions were made. And the most notable one, of course, by one of China's richest people, Wang Jianlin, who acquired the U.S. chain of cinemas called AMC Entertainment Holdings. And just a quick one on Oxford Dictionary. They've updated with some Malaysian words such as abing, ayo, and atas.
You're kidding. Abing,
rendang, and mama also.
So there you go. Malaysia, it's okay now to use Manglish, right, as a result of
I
Oxford.
Like that atas has gone into the Oxford.
Of course you would.
Because I use it a lot. I use the word a lot in a derogatory term.
You know, the thing about a dictionary, right, is that when you kind of have to have, you can almost use it anywhere. Words there can be used anywhere. But how do you use a word like, if you came from another country, how would you even begin to use words like rendang, mama, and atas? That's what I don't quite understand about their inclusion in the dictionary. How would they be used beyond Malaysia and Singapore?
It's like how we use kampong la. It's like, you know, like when a masala comes, like, let's go to the mamak,
well,
man.
So a mark and amo have an old, there's a history to it, right? And
colonialist, I'm sure.
Yeah, even pre-colonial. And so, you know, and it's changed in its meaning. But what I'm saying is that, yes, some words do in fact suddenly become globalized in its meaning and usage. But rendang, maybe in a couple of hundred years, mama would become big.
I just want these
sure.
words, these dictionary-approved words, to be on Words with Friends as soon as possible. I want to use them. Okay, we'll be back with more conversations after this. BFM 89.9. Good morning, BFM 89.9 is 6:22 a.m. on Wednesday, September 14, and you're with Melissa Idris, Sharat Kutin, and myself, Julian Ng. Now, have you been to an atas restaurant and not being treated very well by the atas waiters? It's a word now in the Oxford English Dictionary, so I can use it. Well, a restaurant in Kolkata refused entry to some people because they didn't want to serve the driver, apparently.
Yeah, right. So this is a story about a woman who was so grateful to her driver that she said to him, I want to take you to a really nice restaurant. And when she got there, initially the maitre d' or whatever you call him, said, well, you know, you have to wait for 15 minutes. But then they noticed the driver with her. And I think what happened was, they came back to her and said, well, it's going to be 45 minutes. And then she said, why 45 minutes? You just told me it was going to be 15 minutes. And then when she peered in, she saw, and then they told her, oh, the you know, the...
It's fully booked.
That no, the people at that table had decided to order yet another course and they were staying long, and that's why it's, you know, she was going to be delayed. And then when she looked in, she saw that the table was empty, and then she kicked up a fuss. And then they sort of admitted that it was because the driver, according to them, wasn't well dressed, so not dressed appropriately. And because she says she denies it, and then they said that he was drunk, which he also denies. And so it was all this elaborate kind of acrobatics on the part of the restaurant to deny entry to the chauffeur, clearly on the basis of class. I mean, just didn't want him there because he was from a different class, at least whether that, whatever think, hierarchy that's called.
You don't think that they were enforcing their own rules for a dress code?
No. So she denies that he was inappropriately dressed. So,
right.
So then it became this big social thing on social media, and people were calling for a boycott and such. And, you know, I think a lot of us would probably say, yes, on the basis of some sort of ethics of, you know, equality, that people should all be allowed.
Yeah.
But I wonder if, and I was a thought that crossed my mind when I read the story was, you know, is a restaurant a public institution that has to uphold, you know, like rules of egalitarianism? Or
it's a private property, though. I mean, restaurants are private businesses, right? So as such, they can and have the right to refuse service to anyone they deem.
Okay, what if they said they didn't like women and so they decided,
But that's where there are certain protections in place, right? So that's where the law or the Constitution overrides this.
Do we have the, does the Constitution
wait, hang on. The Constitution also promotes egalitarianism, right? It doesn't say that this is okay.
Yeah, no, but you see, but well, I think we're jumping from very different the Constitution.
Okay,
provisions against
discrimination
might not apply in this thing. So you say, well, okay, because somebody said, well, if you can't discriminate against people. You say, well, what about dress code? Is dress code discriminatory, or is it just enforcement of club rules?
Well, I looked up this right to refuse service, and I found a US example. Maybe we can use that. So this is in the US, right? So they have the right to refuse service to people, and there are legitimate reasons for a restaurant to refuse service, including people who are rowdy or causing trouble, maybe they have an overcapacity. So things like refusing service to patrons, they can't refuse service on the basis of race, color, religion, gender, or national origin. So, for instance, the example here is a person can't be refused service due to having a lazy eye.
Okay, a lazy eye. So okay, you know, what about, remember that was that hotel in Petaling Street that didn't want Asians? It only wanted white people.
That's right. Remember that
story?
Well, Why?
That's their policy.
Their policy
reason.
Was, I think they think white people are more fun.
Oh.
I don't know. They want to just backpackers. No, I don't think it was a money issue. It really was an atmosphere thing. And their excuse was that Asians or non-white people were rowdy, smelly, whatever. I don't know, whatever excuse they gave. But the point was they were trying to find a way of enforcing a particular kind of atmosphere. You know, maybe the idea was that European tourists will only be comfortable around other European tourists. I mean, I'm not quite sure the thinking behind it, but it caused a lot of consternation among the Malaysian public, right?
That's exactly the point. I mean, you can adopt any kinds of policy that you want, but it's up to your customers to walk away. And I think that the question to be asked is, if you're being treated in such a way, why would you then still want to patronize that particular establishment, right?
What if you're the privileged lot? So here it is, right? It's all fine if you're the smelly, scruffy one that's going to be turned away. Of course, you don't want to go to that restaurant. But what if you're the well-turned-out person, the person who not only doesn't have a lazy eye, but is so beautiful that every restaurant wants you in, or every club?
But
this
that
happens
exists.
At clubs, right?
Oh, yeah, clubs.
I'm not saying it's right, but it exists around the world. So you just take your patronage elsewhere. But if you're one of the few privileged one, and if that particular establishment serves your very specific needs, then I also think there is a right for people to run that kind of business. But I do agree with some kind of constitutional overrule about certain unfair policies, discriminatory policies, for example.
Okay.
I don't think that's right.
Well, what about, so I'm just looking at
this. But there's a very thin line, you know, between dress code and equality.
What about someone, this restaurant had turned away a patron who they claim was lacking adequate hygiene. That means they thought he smelled bad and they turned him away. Is that acceptable for a private business?
Well, that's a really interesting one. I mean, I do find that if a restaurant doesn't keep out, somebody who's begging. And I remember there used to be one that, you know, a beautiful restaurant that, you know, had a kind of al fresco thing. I mean, al fresco, it was a coffee shop. Coffee shop under the stars, you kind of sit. And then this beggar would always come by and he was he smelled bad, he looked bad, and he would always drool. So he'd just stand there and drool. And so, you know, my compassion was moved more by self-interest, meaning, here, take some money and please go away. It should have been the restaurant's responsibility to protect me from, you know, losing my appetite. I mean, I'm not sure. It just seemed cruel because clearly the man was in need. I mean, you know, he wasn't doing it just to get the money. I mean, he clearly was dispossessed and, out of sorts.
It's a tricky one, I would have to say. It's
and
really
I think that in today's world, our customers, we customers are getting more and more aware. You know, in a world of social media and reality TV, we frown on certain things. So it's not just a matter of being quite specific about your customer group. If you offend the public, you will lose business. There will be backlash.
I have to say, that is a caveat, though. There is this Cha Kway Teow stall in Penang that I go to, even though the owner always yells at the customer. So she always yells at people. She's constantly yelling because she's an angry woman.
Yeah, but, you know,
but I just go and wait there anyway. Because the food is good.
Okay, we'll be back with more stories. But in the meantime, here is Keith Kam with the day's first news, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:40 in the morning. And you've just heard Last Train to London by the Electric Light Orchestra. And I believe, Sharad, that's your favourite song, isn't it?
I love it. I'm dancing.
We all love it. We're all dancing in the studio. You're with...
Well, yeah, that was kind of the end of a long night, because if you listen to the lyrics, it's about taking the last train, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it should be actually the last train out, right?
The train of shame. Well, you're listening to Melissa Idris, Sharad Kutin, and myself, Julian Ng. Expensive property has made the news again in Malaysia in the last week about how developers can now lend money at 12 to 18% interest rates to home buyers. And earlier, we were talking about egalitarianism in restaurants. What about housing? That's a much bigger issue, right? Well, an article in the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong is lamenting the fact that when Hong Kongers buy and live in 200 square feet apartments and pay an average of Hong Kong dollar 25,000 per square feet. That's about 12,000 ringgit, I believe, per square feet, per square foot. There's something seriously wrong about that society.
200 square feet. How big is that?
That's not more than...
That's like a... That's
well, according
tiny.
To the headline of the article, that's not bigger than a parking space.
Oh my God. Wow.
So is it because, Julian, I mean, you lived in Hong Kong. Is it because people choose to live in the most densely populated parts of Hong Kong rather than where there's, you know, it's where there's not much land, rather than move into the new territories, which I believe is much more spacious?
So like it's a choice that they make to live within the city.
I think there are some spillover effects from central Hong Kong as well. And depending on how conspiratorial you want to be, a lot of people believe that it's a rigged game because the land supply on the Hong Kong island is very much limited. And the government there apparently works with the developers to really rig up the price of property in Hong Kong. And when these pieces of land, supply of land is released gradually into the market, it really helps the developers more than home buyers. But what choices do they have? Because Hong Kong is, after all, an island.
So let's talk about what this does to a society, right? So a society that lives in really small spaces at home, I would guess would spend most of their time outside of home. So that would mean you're either working or you're socializing, and the home is just essentially to sleep and change. It's like a hotel room.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right about that, because people are always game to go out. And when you go out onto the streets of Hong Kong has one of the highest people densities in the world, right? I don't know, a few thousand people fitting into a very small area. And you go to a place like Causeway Bay, it's just a sea of people.
Well, that's, I think when it comes to public housing, say in a country like Singapore, I'm familiar with, there's always the question of community that arises with public housing, whether the structure and the, you know, it's not just the size of the homes, but how space is structured in these public housing estates. Do they create a sense of community? Do they create spaces that are safe for individuals, especially women? Are they spaces that are safe for children? And, you know, in societies like Singapore, where you're likely to have both parents working, what do you do? I mean, what happens to children coming back from school? You know, are you likely to have kids, you know, what they call latchkey kids, you know, kind of stuck at home with the doors bolted? I mean, these are all these other attendant questions which have public policy implications.
Right.
I think for a society like Hong Kong and Singapore, you can see that a lot of these conveniences and public amenities are available no matter where you are. Hong Kong is really very well equipped with public transportation, shops and so on. So is Singapore, right? It doesn't matter where you live in Singapore, you still get access to all the conveniences. But the point is, how do you provide affordable housing in a society where people will buy into a 200 square feet flat? I mean, and if you extrapolate that problem back home to Malaysia, I guess people also are finding themselves in a fix because there are certain more desirable areas and others not so. And many people can't even afford their own homes.
What happens to relationships? I don't know about you, but I need my, you know, my me time, my away space. I can't, you know, be constantly together all the time.
Yeah, so you can imagine a family cramped in a small
exactly.
space.
Exactly. So in like a, for instance, most of the private homes that's been sold in Hong Kong, maximum half of the private homes had a sellable area of 540 square feet. You know, imagine fitting a family of four in that space. And having no breaks from each other, what does that do to the nucleus family, that relationship? Yeah. Does it solidify it or does
you go
it
fracture
out,
it? You go out to a park,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
But Hong Kong is already so small with space constraints and so many people.
Actually, there are quite a lot of parks in Hong Kong.
Okay,
and you can,
there you go. That's
there
probably
hiking
a bonus.
Spaces,
but there are also questions of, again, about relationships, but then this time between different homes and households, which is the question of neighborliness.
Yeah.
Also, you need space from your neighbors, you know.
I think when you live in that kind of society, you get used to it. I never had any problems.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, so in some sense, it's all relative. People are, adapt, and people are immensely adaptable. The question, of course, is the downside to it. So people might adapt, but there might be all kinds of things that
repressed.
Unintended. Yeah, you know, consequences, you know, increasing tensions, people jostling and competing for space, and such things like that, that might actually be exacerbated by these conditions. Right?
But I guess the bigger question is, how do you provide affordable housing? Because
for this.
It's not just a matter of, living in a small space and having your own personal privacy space. It's really a question of how people can have access into those spaces at all.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's a conundrum.
How do you provide that for a country like Malaysia?
So, again, the question is whether the state must step in, and provide public housing, maybe subsidize, and also
rent-to-own schemes.
Sorry?
Rent-to-own
schemes, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of ways to make people homeowners. I think that's often seen as a mark of a good society, that's high levels of homeownership. But if your conspiracy theory that you mentioned earlier, Julian, is true, and there is some collusion between the state, that owns the land and developers, then that must be broken.
The handful of them, right.
Yeah. And, you know, and this is the thing, right? So unless you can break that relationship and you can break the collusion that's happening between those who own the land banks and the developers, we're not going to go very far.
I'd just like to point out something from this article from the South China Morning Post, right? Something really struck me here. A friend of the author who lives in Wan Chai says that he lives in a subdivided flat of 80 square feet. 80 square feet. It has a bathroom and space for a fridge. The bed is a Japanese fold away, so it's folded away during the day. And being 190 centimeters tall, he has to lie on it diagonally. So can you imagine what that's like? And the article says that it's only a matter of time before Japanese-style pods and capsule apartments will make an appearance in Hong Kong.
I would be completely claustrophobic. I'd kill myself if I had to live in that kind of pod.
Yeah, imagine that, you know, you don't even have enough space in the house that you live in that you have to sleep diagonally.
Yeah, very tough times. Just connected to this news, there is another news coming out of the H markets in Singapore. Singapore has been ranked fourth globally for the love of money, surprise, surprise. But thanks to Gen Y, and this is research that's been done by State Street, which I believe is one of the biggest financial institutions in the world.
Okay, so when I read the headline's very catchy. So Singapore ranks fourth globally for the love of money, thanks to Gen Y. Now, if you read about this, State Street's Center for Applied Research is a research firm. They define love as a measure of attitude towards money exhibited by a person, which the company has distinguished from money being treated as a product in the person's current financial situation. So that means you do things motivated by money. It's not like you love the money that you already have, but whatever actions you do, it's motivated by money. Now, Sharad, we spoke about yesterday whether you would choose money or time, right? If you had the choice, what would bring you more happiness, money or time? And in the US, 64% of people chose money. And, you know, I just wanted to say that this is not limited to the US. Here in this part of the world, we also will choose money if that's an option.
Yeah, partly I've known this is a conceptual issue that people will say, well, if I have money, then I can buy time. But the reverse is not true. I mean, if you have time, it doesn't mean you can translate that time into money. So maybe that's how people think about it. And again, it may be also which stage in your life you are. But Singaporeans loving money, I can see why. I mean, again, it's about lacking space, right? What can you do?
Back to that. It depends on what time, what part of your life you're at. So Gen Ys have reported significantly higher love of money compared to other age categories. Is that significant?
See, that's what surprised me about the headline about how Gen Ys love money, which is the generation that was more giving and don't care about money. That's millennials,
yeah,
right? Okay.
Yeah.
So it's Gen Ys that are to blame for this.
So the question is, what kind of consumerism, right? I mean, you've defined, you know, how it's become almost impossible to define, to talk about time off without talking about going to have a vacation, you know? And budget at travel has made it such that people feel guilty or silly not using their vacation holiday time, not going anywhere, just staying at home.
But
we also, you need to explain it now.
True.
We also have other very liberating factors that expand our wallets. For example, you mentioned budget air travel. There's now Uber and Grab that avoids the need to own a car. There are things like Muji and Uniqlo that really targets aspects of your life that before this you had to spend like a copious amount of money just to make yourself presentable, right? You don't need to do that now. So people, I think, are getting slightly richer because of a lot of these internet models and business models that are coming out, expanding the size of our wallets.
Well, you know, there used to be a time. I mean, this is like way, way in the past when money didn't define all the things that when it wasn't the only way to have pleasure. So you know, and we talked about this yesterday when we talked about the time money trade-off issue. I mean, things, you know, you could do a lot of things very cheaply, in fact, without much cost. But today, it's impossible to think of it. It's impossible to even imagine parents making toys for their children, you know, or giving a child a cardboard box and say, hey, you know, imagine this is a castle.
Oh, my God, imagine that all the upset kids if you gave them a cardboard box for their birthday.
Yeah, I mean, they'll think, you know,
I want
cheapskate
my
parent,
virtual
right?
reality helmet.
Yeah,
is that a
exactly.
helmet? Is that what they call it? A helmet?
Goggles.
Goggles,
yeah.
Goggles.
So.
All right, it's 6:52 a.m. and we're going to talk more about money under Market Watch, where Dodge Dolan is going to join us. So stay tuned for that, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.